This is Mary Flynn, one of the editors of Blackbird, and I'm sitting at VCU with Ron Smith, who was kind enough to give us a poem for Blackbird number 2, a poem about Greece. Ron has written with some regularity about places to which he has traveled, and we're going to try to talk a little bit about the role that travel plays to a degree in poems and literature. Thinking of the old line of there's no frigate like a book, there's that kind of travel, there's the travel when the poet or the author goes somewhere like Johnson or Boswell and reports back on the journey. There are different kinds of travel in literature. What does travel do for you as a poet? Does it stoke your muse flame or what?
You know, when you asked me to think about this, I thought, well, this is a good thing to think about because I haven't actually thought it all through either in my own work or in the books and the poems I read. And as I was driving down, I thought, I might actually figure this out during the interview and then I won't have to write about it or travel anymore. So I'm sort of hoping I still won't quite know what I'm talking about when we finish, if you know what I mean. Emily Dickinson's a good place to start since she never traveled. She left New England, twice in her life, I think, something like that. It seems to me that writers travel probably for the same reason everybody else does, and that's to make the world new, to be able to see things again. And familiarity makes you blind, and you can't even see your own neighborhood until you come back from a trip. And then you see what your yard looks like, and you see what your neighbor looks like, and you didn't realize how hunched over he was before you left, and that sort of thing. So I think in general, I travel to... Usually I have a destination. I'm a sort of a pilgrim traveler. I'm doing a pilgrimage usually, a very skeptical pilgrimage. I like Mark Twain's approach to the Holy Land as a pilgrim. He had almost nothing positive to say as he traveled through the Holy Land. But he went there as a pilgrim to a sacred site, either without or with the quotation marks. And he did have some real spiritual experiences. And so I go hoping to find a kind of sacred site. I mean, if you call the Appian Way, the Via Appia sacred, I've gone there 3 times in particular, Dolores and I, just to see it and to trace it, thinking that we'd find something ultimate, and knowing we might not.
What kind of ultimate, in particular on the Appian Way?
Well, I don't know. Italy is one place that I go every chance I get, partly because it has so many layers of time, and you can see the layers of time just by looking down the street, down the road. But partly space travel, travel through space, is time travel, I think. Trying to see Terracina the way Horace saw it, but knowing you can't, knowing that you can only get a glimpse of it from time to time. Or not too far off the Appian Way, the Lake of Avernus, Lago Alverno, and Cume. Being in the cave at Cume was as chilling, as thrilling as I'd hoped it would be.
Did the Sibyl speak?
The Sibyl did not speak. The Sibyl left behind some strong urine smell in a couple of parts of the cave, some of her henchmen. But, you know, I didn't know I'd had this same reaction until I read, after I'd been there, Mark Twain going to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. He was just angry the whole time he was in Israel, I think, at the desecration and the commercialism. And he went into the Holy Sepulchre angry mainly because, if I remember the passage correctly, the Christians needed Muslim guards to keep them from fist fights. Fighting over the square of the church, etc. So he went in there, as I went in there, sort of already with a chip on my shoulder, having to pack in with all the tourists and go up to the place where you're actually going to see the spot of the crucifixion. And there are people there with video cameras and all kinds of flash cameras and jostling and lots of picture taking. There's something very magical about it, very holy and powerful. And I got back and read that Twain had the same experience. Just out of the blue, kind of sideswiped him.
And there is something interesting about those sites that have been either pilgrimage or tourist sites for a very long time, that you can go to places and see the initials of people from 1800 or...
Yes.
Does that fascinate you too?
Yes. As I say, I'm usually, I'm almost always, I hadn't thought about this until the last couple of days, but I'm going there as a pilgrim, but always skeptical. When I went to Canterbury, I thought, well, you know, this will be just overrun with tourists, because you always want to be the only tourist there. But one of the wonderful things about Canterbury is that it's been a tourist site for so many hundreds of years. And so has Athens, and so has Rome, and so has Cumae. And yeah, there is something really wonderful about being the millionth visitor. And you know it because you've read that Byron carved his name on the temple at, what's the name of that place? Sunyan.
Sunyan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are famous writers' names carved in the window at Shakespeare's birthplace in Stratford. I always see those things with irony and humor, and yet you have these moments, these wonderful moments of, I don't know, peak experiences.
Where you're seeing the same things that they saw. It can be quite fascinating. I know when we went to the Peshmerga caves outside Cahors a couple of years ago, where they have the handprints of the painters, and you could, if you were allowed, put your handprint where that print was, and sort of touch it across those years.
Yeah.
Do you think it's things like that that provoke the poems, or is it just the difference? Are the poems a conversation with the other people who've been there? Thinking of Greece, a conversation with Homer? Or
for all the traveling I've done, the many hours and hours of travel, I've written very few poems, very few lines really about them. It's very frustrating. I've been going to Italy since 1990 and filling up notebooks with what I assumed would be poems. And year after year, I couldn't get poems out of them for some reason. They were, well, I wrote drafts, but they were all sort of travelogues or funny anecdotes or something. They didn't seem worthy of more than a few drafts. So I don't know. It seems to me that there has to be a certain distance between me and the experience before I can actually see it clearly. So part of the reason that I'm writing a lot of poems about Italy now is that the trips were so long ago. There's a kind of a mist of time between the now of the writing or the rereading the journal and the then of the experience. And somehow the gap in time makes me able to see the experience more clearly. I'm not quite sure how that works, and I'm not sure I've answered your question.
But thinking of the poem Greece that we have, and the poem about, I think it was Ithaca, that you read here a couple of years ago at the museum, and I think it's been published by the Georgia Review.
Georgia Review.
Those are both Greek poems, and one thinks of Ithaca, one immediately thinks of Odysseus.
Yes. Homer is the first travel poet, and Odysseus the first real traveler in literature, I suppose. He has a very specific mission. He wants to get home, and he doesn't want, I mean, he just wants to be home and be normal, if Odysseus could ever be normal. But he doesn't want to be immortal. He's offered immortality, and he's offered all kinds of magical things along the way, but he just wants to get home, and yet he's not home. And that tension, I think, between being the person you are from the place you are and being in a strange place. I haven't written about England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. I've got notebooks and travel notes and journals, but I haven't really written poems about those things. I think I will in the future. But the one trip, the very short trip we took to Israel, I could write about right away, and I wrote a number of poems about being in Israel. Greece is a little bit similar. I guess they're both exotic enough to me that I can see them more clearly, and they stick in the mind, and they kind of worry parts of my mind and sensibility, so that I have to write about them and keep writing about them.
Do you feel, particularly thinking of Italy, and the number of English writers or English writing poets and writers who have written about Italy in one way or another, from Charles Wright, who's up the road, to Ezra Pound, to a fellow who was reading at a conference I was at a couple of summers ago after he'd been to Venice, and the fiction writer said afterwards, there ought to be a law that gets letting these poets go to Italy and write these poems.
Especially Venice, I think.
Do you feel them sort of crowded in with you if you're thinking about writing about Italy?
I don't. I guess I haven't read a lot of what I consider to be really wonderful poems about Italy, although every writer has to go there, practically, and has to write about it for the reasons we've already talked about. Because you can see and feel layers and layers of history, century upon century. They all seem to be right there.
Dante was right there, too.
Well, you know, I was thinking about Dante as I drove over here.
Speaking
of journeys and travel writers, I mean, he is a travel writer. And not only is he the character traveling through hell and purgatory and then finally paradise, but he's constantly comparing the mountains in hell to the mountains in Italy, or the cliff here to the cliff, you know, outside Ferrara or some such place. But his was a forced journey, a bit like Odysseus. And the very fact that they don't want to travel, but they're traveling, creates a certain charge in their descriptions and in their response to the landscape and to the world in front of them. I think part of the tradition we're talking about here is people north of the Alps being able to cross the Alps and be in the Mediterranean. I think that's has a lot to do with it. There's something wonderful about being in that part of the world anyway, especially if you're an Englishman, I'm sure, or a German, or those Scandinavian writers, Ibsen and those people who had to go to Rome and such places. You can live outside, which you can't do north of the Alps. And that creates another thing about Italy, or suggests another thing about Italy that I think I need, and that is I'm so puritanical, I need to be around the Italians, because they know how to live. They know how to enjoy being alive. One of the things I've learned about the Italians is that old stereotype I grew up with, the Italians, you know, they couldn't win a war if it were given to them. They're so inefficient. It's just completely wrong. I think the Italians could conquer the world if they wanted to.
They did once.
That's right. Well, those were the Romans. But and most Italians would say, we're not Romans. There's no connection. But they don't want to. They want to make the best pasta within 1,000 miles, and the best life, and the best shoes, and even, you know, the best art. There are many Italys, really, but in general, I think that's true, that you go to Italy to learn how to be alive, not just to see the Caravaggios, which does help you to be alive.
Where have you traveled lately?
Well, speaking of poets, because I was doing a lot of reading in Byron and Shelley, I felt I had to go to the Gulf of Poets, and so we were in Liguria this past summer. And Liguria is wonderful. It's one of the places that I've sort of stayed away from because it seemed like such an obvious place to go. Sort of like Paris. You don't want to go to Paris. Everybody goes to Paris. When I finally went to Paris, I realized what a wonderful, wonderful city it was. But we went there, and I had the same experience with the Gulf of Poets, which is named that apparently because of Shelley and Byron living there, that I had when I first went to Walden Pond to make the pilgrimage to the site of Thoreau's cabin. Pulled up there in August, saw, not entirely to my surprise, that there was a beach with 4 lifeguards sitting up on lifeguard chairs. In a fatalistic frame of mind, I walked up to the first lifeguard and asked, excuse me, could you tell me where the site of Thoreau's cabin is, knowing she was going to say exactly what she said. Who? Oh, I don't know, she said. Ask her. She's been here longer than I have. So I asked the head lifeguard. And she had a vague idea that there was something like that around to the right. It was about a half mile away. I think of Casamagni, where Shelley was living when he died. In the descriptions I've read all my life of the sea washing right up into the lower floor, it's so desolate and isolated. So I had to see this house where Shelley and Mary Shelley and everybody else that came by were living. And there it is, right on a beach now. Actually, there's a road in front of it and then a beach. Almost none of the Italians who were there knew why it was called the Gulf of Poets or what that building back there was. And there's something wonderful about that, I think. There's something about that combination of the past and the present and the frivolous attitude toward the past, which is not entirely frivolous, but is just vital and alive. That is wonderful. I didn't like Rome the first time I went to Rome, by the way. I had a reaction. I had remembered reading what Joyce said about Rome. He hated Rome. He got out of Rome as soon as he could. He said that Rome reminded him of a man who made his living by displaying the corpse of his grandmother. And I didn't think of that until I was there overnight, tripped down from the Italian Alps. And I had a very negative reaction to Rome, and then I remembered what Joyce had said about it. But it was partly because, by the way, a lot of people had a reaction to Rome, first trip, apparently. But now Rome is probably my favorite big city in the world.